But it's also sort of pick your spots. Like, you probably can't do that every 3 seconds. So
thank you.
Where do you know?
House Committee on Revenue for April 29th will come to order. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3261. Give us a quick reminder, if you would, Christine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3261 provides for the issuance of tax warrants to the county by directly from the Department of Revenue, and it bypasses the warrants for the sheriff to seize and sell taxpayers' real and personal property. The Dash 2 amendment adds a requirement that the department mail or deliver a copy of the warrant to the taxpayer prior to delivering the warrant. And the Dash 1 amendment before it, which also includes, is included within the Dash 2,
mm-hmm.
It requires the Department of Revenue to record a warrant in the county clerk lien record prior to directing the sheriff to levy upon the property. And it requires the department to authorize an agent to collect the taxes if the warrant will be executed by an agent other than the sheriff.
Okay. Mr. Phillips? I'm sorry.
Deborah?
I just want to find out if it's true, if the department is okay with this change.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Yes, we are.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Berger?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3261.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3261. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3261 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 3261 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass. Who would like to carry? I'll carry. Barnhart will carry. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3261. Open a work session on House Bill 2546.
House Bill 2546 with the Dash 1 amendment would allow a late filing of a claim for exemption from property taxation for 5 years prior to the current tax year. And this late filing would be accompanied by a filing fee of the greater of either $200 or 0.1% of the real market value of the property to which the claim pertains. The Dash 1 amendment restricts the late filing for property tax exemptions to first-time filers who show good cause for failing to file a timely claim, or public entities. So either filers who show good cause, or public entities, or first-time filers may be allowed to do this under this amendment. And there is an indeterminate revenue impact, depending on how many taxpayers step forward to claim these exemptions. It's not known at this time, and there is a fiscal impact statement of no expenditure impact on this measure.
Thank you. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I understand this is a very narrowly defined subset of folks who it is not in any way broad, and it would only apply to a very few filers that might get caught.
Thank you. Yes, that's right. The issue that this addresses came to my attention as a result of a tax assessment on a nonprofit daycare program that was meeting in the basement of a church, where neither the church nor the nonprofit daycare program had filed the required notices for the use of the property being other than for church uses. And this bill does not go back and cover that situation. It only is prospective. But it puts into place essentially the same rule that we passed in connection with a simpler process involving churches themselves in the last session. So it kind of adds on, deals with an additional exception, but it follows the rule we adopted last time.
Yes.
Any other comments? Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2546.
Representative Berger moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2546. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2546 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 2546 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, it is so ordered. And I think that's probably one I should carry. Anybody want to carry it? Burning desire? None?
No,
I'll carry the bill. With that, we'll close the work session. Colleagues, we have two other work sessions and two public hearings on our calendar for today. I don't think we're ready to do anything further on 2328 today. Is that right, Representative Berger?
That's correct.
So can we carry this forward? Will we be ready on Monday? Let's carry it forward till Monday. Does that work for you?
Works for me.
Okay, let's carry it forward. Carry 2328, House Bill 2328, to Monday. The other item we have is for work session is House Bill 2543, and I think we'll open the work session on that and ask Mr. Bennett, Mr. Phillips, for additional comments that they may have. This bill isn't ready to work today, but we did want to hear from the department and AARP about the comments that they wanted to make this morning. Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. As you know, I've been a member of the work group that has been looking at this legislation and trying to come up with some changes that would provide for long-term sustainability of the property tax deferral program. And the -3 amendments incorporates the recommended changes that we've come up with from the work group. However, there is one item that has come up more recently that was not discussed, at least with the larger work group, and that has to do with the 5% cap that is in Section 4 of the amendment. That's on page 9. Now, I understand, I think I understand the reason for having a cap on the number of participants in the program. It's my understanding that the modeling that's been done indicates that without a cap of some type, the long-term sustainability of the program would be in question, and perhaps might make it more difficult to obtain some type of short-term financing that's also required. However, the cap speaks to initial claims and so forth, new versus ongoing claims that might be approved for the program. And so that brings to mind some questions related to what might actually be considered an initial claim. And in other sections of the bill, I think in Section 11, it speaks to, I think, joint ownership, a homestead of joint ownership. If one spouse I'm assuming it's related to either a death or perhaps a divorce, the remaining spouse for that homestead would, I assume, have to change their or reapply in some fashion. The question is whether, in fact, is that an ongoing claim or a new initial claim? Another thing, the bill now would, or the amendment calls for recertification. Now, again, would this be considered an ongoing claim or a new initial claim? In my mind, it would be an ongoing claim. But, again, I just want to pose that and see what your intent might be in that regard. Also, in Section 12, I think it speaks to the situation where as somebody who is currently participating in the program goes to recertify does not meet the new requirements for participation, say, and so for that year is not allowed, does not get the deferral. If they in the next year are now eligible again and meeting the requirements, again, is that an ongoing claim or a new initial claim? And then...
So excuse me just a moment. No. You're talking about somebody who has been on the program, now no longer meets one of the requirements and goes off the program, and then comes back later because they now meet the requirements. And the question then, if I understand you right, is that a new claim or is it some kind of a continuing claim?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I've got the issue.
Okay. And the other question I have has to do with the 5% cap and a situation where, in fact, the department would receive more claims than allowed by the 5% cap. And then how is it determined who is accepted and who is not? In the amendment, it speaks to an ascending order based on the tax amount, I believe. And I'm just at this point, I'm not sure whether ascending order, descending order, lottery, first come, first serves is the most appropriate way to determine who, in fact, gets in under the 5% cap and who does not.
This is a very good point, and in the middle of the night I thought of that too. So, is there any thought that if you're already in, you're in, and then you take the space that's left in the lot in some way?
But, and it is my assumption that, indeed, we're primarily speaking to those initial or new
exactly. I wanted that on the record,
yeah,
because that would be my vision. We're not tossing people in and out of this program,
right,
according to this cap. So if you're in, you stay in, and then what's left is the capacity under the cap. And what you're suggesting is how would you, and I think...
Well, maybe we ought to hear from Mr. Phillips on that issue, because partly it's an administrative issue and partly it's an issue of how we're trying to, what our policy objectives are.
And again, my assumption is, in fact, we're not talking about those ongoing claims.
Right.
We're talking only about, related to the 5% cap, we're talking about those new initial claims. And again, that's part of the reason for my questioning related to these certain situations and whether, in fact, they would be considered ongoing or new.
Yeah. Mr. Phillips?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue, thank you. Yes, Mr. Bennett brings up some really good points that sometimes don't come up until after session, and we have to sort that out, so I appreciate that.
Me too. I want a definition section of what initial claims means.
Yeah. Initial defined would be really good,
yeah,
because I can think of several ways to define it right now. But in terms of the ascending, descending order and the administrative sort of efficiency or problem that might create, we also, as Rick brought up, the first come, first serve. And that, I think the first in application first would be a problem because we get all of these from 36 counties. So people are filing in the county, and then keeping track of who filed first in which county would be a little bit difficult. And in my opinion, it might not be a fair way to look at it. If you're trying to find a fair way or a way based on need, the first filed might not be a good test. Ascending order and the taxes due is not a perfect test either, but I suggest it might be better than sort of a who filed first kind of a test. There are probably other ways we could think of that could make it more fair, and we could evaluate the administrative difficulty of that if we were to come up with any. But I think that's something we can talk about and work on. I would encourage the committee to move the bill as fast as you can, and if we can work on this on the Senate side, because we are faced with a very challenging situation of maybe not letting seniors know that they're going to be, we're going to be paying their tax or not until maybe the 1st of October, September at least. And so the longer we take, the longer it takes to, we've got to process by hand 12,000 applications. So we're plus design the form as soon as you decide what the criteria is. So there's So I do think these are very important things, and I would love to work with everybody on the Senate side on that, if possible.
Is there any discussion on this issue? I think what we're really talking about is the initial claims question. I can tell you that my thought about it originally was that, was sort of rough and ready, was that people who were in already were not making initial claims, even if they were being recertified. I hadn't thought about the widow problem, the issue of a tenancy by the entirety, which becomes a fee simple tenancy in one person because of the death of the spouse, or, as you say, the divorce. But it would seem to me that the same ought to apply to that, that it's simply a continuation.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
And I would throw into the same pool probably the person who's disqualified for a year and then comes back later.
Indeed, Mr. Chair, I think John and I have discussed this a little bit out in the hallway, and the issue, you know, is it, if it indeed is still related to the same homestead.
Right. Right, and that should be part of the definition of an initial claim. If it's any of these people we've already been discussing and they're filing for a new claim, then is that an initial claim or is it a continuation? I think that's a policy question that the committee might want to weigh in on. But the others, I think, are, at least to me at least, seem pretty simple, that those are not initial claims. And the initial claim is somebody who hasn't ever been qualified before for the house that they're trying to get qualified now.
But, and the last thing I would say is I fully appreciate the concerns expressed by Mr. Phillips and the department related to their need to get this moving, and certainly I'm also open to working on the definition, and if there are additional amendments required to do so in the Senate, that's all right.
Ah, okay. Thank you. Anything else on this? I mean, if anybody disagrees with what I just said, I'd like to hear it now so we can sort of get that figured out, because this will be, if we don't do it here, it should be guidance to the senators for writing the definition of initial claim. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate...
Representative Berger. I'm sorry, Gelser.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate the need to be timely and move this on to the Senate as quickly as possible, but I hope we can take the time and focus and get this as close to right as we can. It's a very important issue, and I think moving it off of our floor, I think our colleagues are going to want to be clear about what it is that we're doing, and I think that there is a substantial risk in sending something to the Senate of this magnitude that's only half-baked.
Well, and especially since we've put quite a bit of work on it, and I don't think there weren't any senators on our work group, were there?
No.
So you're probably right that we need to be able to send them something and get it as close to perfect as we can so that they don't have to work it very much. That makes sense.
And following up on the other comment, I would agree with you about the idea of an initial claim when you're talking about a taxpayer in the same home. If you're talking about a taxpayer in a newly purchased home or a new taxpayer in the same home, I think those would all be new claims.
I think we're getting the germs of a definition. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Berger.
That being said, I we're not half-baked. We're very near the end.
Yeah, we are.
So with these kinds of changes, if we could nail them down as quickly as possible, some language, and get this thing moving, there may be other small finishing tweaks. Somebody's going to put the egg white on the crust. But we do need to get this moving because we've got a timeline here. I really wanted this out a month ago.
Yeah.
Because we've got people piling up to who have this need.
Well, that's another deadline that nobody wants to talk about.
Yeah.
And that's the end of session.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Representative Gelser.
I'm happy to talk about the end of session.
Thank you. All right. Any sense as to how long it would take us to get a definition section written and a new amendment drafted?
The Ledge Council drafter, Alan Dale, is not here today. However, I think it shouldn't be too difficult. There are also a couple of other outstanding issues.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
There's one, the question of requiring the applicant to have actually owned their property for 5 years. Currently, the language says have lived in the property for 5 years, and I think the requirement that they have actually owned the property for 5 years might be more the intent. Ensure that there's at least probably some equity into the property if it's a newly purchased home by the time they apply.
Representative Benz, do you have a comment on that issue?
I don't.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, the purpose of the 5 years was to be sure that the homeowners had enough skin in the game that we weren't giving this to people who were flipping or had just purchased a home that was outside of their. So I think home ownership would be part of the requirement.
Right. I thought the bill actually did require home ownership, but it wasn't obvious in reading the section in which that was described, but going to another section that described what homestead meant. Now, maybe I'm wrong, and if I am wrong, then we need an amendment to fix that.
Okay.
Sure.
Anything else today? Can we have this?
Is there another one?
Well, there was just the question of the mortgages and whether the liens the Department of Revenue has under this program, where they stand in the list of priorities, if they're with tax liens or not. And
I think it's pretty clear they cannot be tax liens in the traditional sense.
Yeah,
that would be another change.
Right. We'll go back to the rule that we currently have, which is they go in the order that they're filed in the deed records, which makes them junior to mortgages that were entered into before and senior to mortgages that come after. But, of course, no bank is going to make a mortgage in which this lien isn't paid off as part of closing. So they would pay us off and get us off the books, and then any new tax deferral through this mechanism would go on the books after the mortgage. And I think that's the understanding that we have, and that means keeping the rule that we currently have rather than changing it in this bill. So that might require a change in the amendments sequence that you're working on. Representative Berger.
This, again, the five-year ownership, I think, takes the worry off the table on this one, that someone's turning this in some way. So that was the original remedy for this problem. I think it still holds.
Mr. Chair, to build on that,
please,
just for purposes of the record,
yes,
it has to be clear that we've made a decision that keeping the folks in the home is more important than our security position. That, because obviously the 5 years is a imprecise means of establishing equity. And so we're making that choice by using that as our qualifying device.
I think you're right. We are using that as a qualifying device, and it is possible that new home purchases, especially ones in the last couple of years, may be underwater at this point. And so when a person qualifies in a couple or 3 years more, they could be in a situation where the home is underwater. But what we've done to protect ourselves around that issue is that we've limited it to median-priced homes, median-priced in the county. You only get the higher-priced homes, higher-valued homes, for people who've been in the home much longer, and you're more likely to be protected. You're also protected in the event that there is a reverse mortgage or a subsequent mortgage, because the mortgagee, in order to protect their own interest, is going to insist that this be paid off because this lien becomes senior to that lien. Yes.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
I agree with the point you made.
Okay.
But I think you're right.
I'm just saying that one can look out a little and see that someone could easily take out a second mortgage, could easily use up most of the equity in the home. There's lots of things that could be done that would leave a homeowner that's had the house for many years with absolutely no equity.
Yeah.
And we're not looking at that here, as I understand the device.
If it were entered into before loan lien occurred, you're right. I think that's right.
Just I'm just saying that there were, for purpose of the record, it needs to be clear that we're making that choice here, that we're not looking at equity.
I believe that's correct. My understanding of the issue from the standpoint of the people who represent mortgagees is that they're dealing then with the opposite of the same problem. And that is that if the tax, if our lien become, is superior to theirs, even though it's entered later, then it puts their security at risk. And so it's a mirror image problem, I think, in some ways. Now, we could add an additional requirement that not only do you have to have owned the home for 5 years, but you can't have encumbered it within that time.
We could.
We could add that as a requirement. And that would take care of at least a little piece of the issue you're worried about.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, the fact that they're trying to stay in the home and going through the work of trying to defer the taxes would suggest that they are able to make whatever the payment is on the existing indebtedness. So
right.
That would suggest that they wouldn't go through all this work if they were about to be foreclosed out of the home. So this would be a long-term situation where we have entered into this arrangement, 5 or 10 years go by, their mortgage doesn't get paid, we are foreclosed off. And it wouldn't. So the only way I didn't know of our trying to fix this is that when folks would come in to ask for the deferral, we would make as a condition of our review, I hate to say a title report, but it would have to be something to understand where they are in regards to their mortgage. Alternatively, we're simply taking the risk.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Wand, the lawyers are all talking, as you can
Thank
see.
You.
Yeah, all right, please, go ahead.
And just so that we understand the scope of the risk, do we have an unsecured claim? Excuse me.
No, the claim is secured.
But if there's no equity.
Oh, then it's unsecured, yeah.
So they still owe the debt from the estate.
Can somebody from the department speak on that issue? I don't know whether it's a personal obligation or simply an obligation that runs with the land. I don't know. I forget. I think we had this conversation, but I don't remember.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, probably not the best person to speak on this, but I believe that up in the current law, the lien is against the home, so it's an in rem situation. And under provisions of this bill and the amendments, there's consideration that once the senior dies and there are heirs or trustees, as it's defined in the amendments, that the department could pursue collection through other means like federal tax offsets potentially or warrants or those kinds of things. But under current law, I believe the home is the only asset that can be used as payment for the lien.
Wait.
Thank you.
It's not a personal obligation then. It's a
correct.
It is an obligation of the property.
Correct.
Does that deal with the question you raised?
Well, I think it answers the question, except for there were two parts to the answer that conflicted. And in one, you said that it's an in rem obligation that runs with the land. And then in another part, you said that the trustees or heirs are obligated to make payment back. And then you said, but the only property, only the real property is obliged to pay that. Those are each one is slightly different, and neither one of them, they're conflicting. So this is a key point. When you go through a probate, you have to notify DHS. And then they run a search to find out if the estate owes the state any health costs for whatever it is that we've done. Is there any type of a similar unsecured obligation in the event that the property doesn't sell for enough that's in the probate code?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, under current law, and that was the distinction, I'm sorry I was not very clear on, under current law, it is an in rem proceeding. So there is no personal obligation. Once the home has no value or it's been foreclosed on with no residual, we have to cancel and write off our debt. There's no ability to recover any of the loan money or interest if the equity in the home is gone. And I was trying to make a distinction between that and what's proposed in the bill and the amendment, which is slightly different, significantly different.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
If I could comment to the lawyers among us who spend their professional lives assessing risk.
Dealing with cases, and dealing with cases where the situation has actually come up negatively.
Yes. The biggest threat to this program has been sweeps by this body.
That's right.
Not the occasional property that has come under this particular case. And I think the most important thing we can do is make sure that the solvency going forward, and that's what the cap really does, and if this becomes an issue, we can make adjustments. We have that authority, and I would hope that Mr. Phillips and the DOR would report to us how often this happens. I just don't think we can protect from all risks, is I guess my point.
I think what we can do is in the next amendment, we can ask that not only are you in the property for 5 years before owner of the property and a homestead, using it as your homestead for 5 years prior to application, but also that during that five-year period, you haven't added new encumbrances, so that if you had to put a second mortgage on 2 years after you bought the place, or within the last 5 years, you'd have to wait a couple more years before you could apply. I know that doesn't deal completely at all with the issue you've raised, but it does add some security to it.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
if I may. Keep coming back to our goal, and that's to keep the people in the home.
That's right.
So if that's the ultimate goal, then the security issue kind of goes by the by, and that must have been what folks were thinking when they put this together originally. And
we did live in a different world.
Yes.
And people were far more likely to be concerned about their moral as well as their legal obligations.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, the advent of the second mortgage over the last 10 or 15 years has been pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And the effort to sell those kinds of devices has been pretty amazing. And so I think there's far more folks that are more likely to have those second mortgage obligations on their homes. But that may be that may not be the issue, as Co-Chair Berger continues to point out. The issue is to keep people in the home. And so if that's the case, then the security issue, it's worthy of note only to point out the fact that we're basically making a decision not to have security. That's why I keep saying it. I just want to clear that we can't fool ourselves into thinking that we will get the money back, because we may not.
So you're not interested in the limitation that I just suggested? That's the wrong way of saying it. Given that the different issues that we are trying to balance, it sounds to me as though you may have just said, yes, we have a security problem, but I'm not in favor of adding the encumbrance requirement that I just described.
Right. Mr. Chair, if the answer was every one of these people that came in has just put a second mortgage in place, and would we still go ahead with the program if we could keep them in their homes? The answer might very well be yes, because the property taxes, given the nature of the housing we're dealing with, probably so low it's cheaper to lose the property tax than to move them out of the house into a nursing home.
Yes.
So now you're thinking about the ways and means issue as well.
Right. Why else would we keep them, Mr. Chair, if I may, why else would we try to keep them in their homes?
Well, I can think of several reasons, but that's certainly an important one. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. This is a very useful conversation, I think, for us.
I concur with Representative Pence.
Mr. Chair, if I may. As a person who's represented banks.
So lawyers can actually get out of their legal mind and into a different mindset at the same time. It is possible occasionally.
If I may, I was just trying to explain the difficulty I was having.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it. Now, what went through my mind as I said that was Orlando John Hollis's comment to the beginning law students in 1968 that once I'm through with you, you will always think like a lawyer. And most of the time, he's right, but sometimes he isn't. Yes, Representative Juan.
No, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We appreciate it. And if it works for the committee, then what we're proposing to do several amendments that will fix the issues that the several different pieces of an amendment that will fix the issues that we've been talking about this morning. What I just suggested to Paul is that we add a piece on the encumbrance issue. On second thought, maybe we'll leave that out. We'll leave that piece out, and we won't add an encumbrance requirement. A no encumbrance requirement. You got that? Okay. But the other issues, I think we've answered to Paul at least for the nonce. And I'll check up after the meeting to make certain we've got that. And can we have this ready for Wednesday? That's the next time we meet after Monday, isn't it? Can we carry it over to Wednesday?
You don't need to carry it
out. We don't need to. We can repost. Okay. All right. Anything else on this one? With that. Okay, we'll close the work session then on 3261, and we've finished the work sessions. Let's go to our public hearing. Representative Reed, are you ready?
I am.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2728. Yes, please. Hey.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, House Bill 2728 allows taxpayers to make direct deposit contributions of personal income tax refunds into an Oregon 529 College Savings Network account.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Tobias Reed, State Representative, District 27. You may have heard the story about Albert Einstein. I've checked it out and discovered it's apocryphal, but I like it nonetheless. He was apparently asked what he thought the most powerful force in the universe was, and his answer was compound interest. This is a pretty simple bill in contrast to the one we've been talking about earlier this morning. Simply asks the Department of Revenue to change the tax forms to allow taxpayers to choose to deposit some or all of their refunds into a 529 plan. You've heard me talk in a variety of fora and in a variety of ways about the importance of higher education and the importance of saving for higher education. This is a simple way that I think we can help people do that. And I'm fortunate to be joined by a couple of experts on how this might work. So I'd be happy to take your questions and hope we can move this bill forward.
Thank you. Gentlemen? Go
ahead. Mr. Chair, for the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the 529 program. As Representative Reed said, you know, we're always looking for ways to help Oregonians save for college, and this is just another tool that they can avail themselves of. We've been working closely with the Department of Revenue to work out the technical aspects. We're prepared at the plan level to make this happen, and I think it's a great policy for folks to have some extra cash at tax time to dump some money into the plan. Again, DOR has been very helpful in working out the technical aspects, so any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Ken Ross from the Department of Revenue. As they both have said, this is something that we have worked with them to be able to work it from an administrative point, and we believe the bill covers all that, so we are fine with the language.
Representative Berger?
I have a couple of questions.
Please,
if you'll indulge me. Mr. Parker, how many participants do we have in 529 plans in the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, in the state of Oregon, we have approximately about 75,000 folks in the plan. Plan-wide, we're about 125,000. We have folks out of state that invest in our plan, but looking at Oregonians, you're looking at about 75,000.
So that would be the universe of filers who, and that would be like filers, I mean, if it's a husband and wife or... I'm trying to get a scope of the universe of people who would use this device.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that would be accounts. So you're looking at joint filers would be a little bit less than that. So that's correct.
And Mr. Ross, would this involve then some sort of a checkoff on our forms?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we would probably have to do a schedule and add a line because it would. Right now, we're not set up to do direct deposit into more than one account. So we would have to create a schedule so that they could, if they wanted to do part of their refund into their savings account and part of it into the 529 account, they'd be able to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So I understand you'd have a. here's what I'm getting at, gentlemen. So just so you know. The mechanics of this, I have my taxes done by a tax preparer, not a CPA, and every year the form gets longer that he sends me, do you do this, do you do that, do you do this, do you do that, and I go through it, and it's very useful and helpful. It just seems to grow. So what we're talking about is, are you a participant in a 529 plan, and if I check yes, he goes and gets a different schedule and fills it out for my taxes. Is that what we're talking about here?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, yes, it would be something like that. It would, because you're right, there are already different options for your refund with the charitable checkoff and the political party contribution.
And, you know, do you have child care? Do you have, and do you have retirement? Okay. Okay. Just wanted to be sure exactly what we're talking about here.
How would it look online? More and more of our tax returns are being filed online, aren't they?
Chair Barnhart, that is correct.
And so how would it look online?
It would be that if you were doing your own return and using software, it probably would show up as a question, do you want to donate or deposit part of your refund into a 529 plan? And so it would, I'm guessing that it would show up as a question that you would answer yes or no, and then if you answered yes, then it would take you to a screen to allow you to enter the account information.
And technically, I mean, mechanically, you'd have to have an account number and then an amount that you were going to take out of your refund?
Chair Barnhart, that's correct. You'd have to have the account set up first. With the 529 plan, and then there is a minimum dollar amount. It'd have to be at least $25.
Oh, okay. And so the way you would manage that then is you'd get this tax return from the return preparation company, the online company, and one of the items on the tax return would be send him $25 or more for this account. And you can manage that?
Chair Parner, yes, we could.
All right. Okay. How many people are likely to take advantage of this kind of a plan? Now I'm probably directing it on the edges here. What do we think at this point?
Mr. Chair, I would heat even hazard a guess. However, I will tell you that we are working on plans to really push folks online and to do e-delivery and things like that. And we do try to get the word out if this bill does pass that this option is available to them. So, you know, I would really have no idea, but a lot of folks in our plan are moving to more online, moving to more things to find ways to fund their plan. So I would say, you know, maybe even to Representative Berger's point, we would have a number of folks, I think, take advantage of this option because it's a way to fund a plan that they're not having to take out a current income or their current bank account. It's money that's coming in at the end of the year. So we think people would take advantage of it.
Mr. Chair, I'd add a couple of things to that. One is this is, I think, very much in line with the sort of thing that at least I think is important when it relates to things like the kicker. When someone has an unexpected source of income or a little extra that they weren't counting on, I think it's important for us to give them good options to do smart things with it, and saving for the future is one of those examples. It also gives me a chance to mention another bill, which I hope will come to the floor. It's now in the Ways and Means Committee for a variety of reasons that I won't bore you with, that would ask the health authority to send a data file to the 529 529 network with names and addresses of new parents, so the 529 network can let them know parents who are newly have newly large families to start a 529 program or an account early. So hopefully the number will grow from 75,000 to a much larger number, and people will be thinking about that and more easily able to take care or take advantage of the opportunity when they have refunds.
And if I could just make one more comment to that, as I said, if this bill does pass, we will actively let account owners know that this is an option that they have at tax time. So we will be proactive to try to get the word out to account owners that they can fund their account in this way.
Okay. How does one go about setting up an account? And would this bill lead you to add any options to the whatever those methods are?
Chair Barnhart, setting up an account is very easy. It's we have a form you fill out. Basically, we need your name and address, your social number, name and address and social number of your beneficiary, and what account or option you want to put the account in. You can either do it paper or you can do it online. So setting up an account is very easy. Under this bill, you must have an account first. So if you wanted to do this at tax time, as you're doing your taxes and you don't have an account, you can set an account up with us pretty quickly, get your account number back from us over a couple-day period, and put it on your tax form. So this could prompt you to open an account as well and fund it, but you must have an account number with us and an established account before you actually can take advantage of this.
So you need to figure out a method to send an account number back instantly rather than in a couple of days.
If you open an account online, it's an instant process to get a confirmation back and an account number. If you open it...
I can envision someone sitting there filling out tax return online, coming to this question and saying, oh, that's a good idea. Push the minimize button on the browser, open a new browser window, go to the web address that is in the tax form for your form, fill out your form, get an instant account number, enter the maximize that form again, stick that account number in the tax return, and enter a number for the amount from the refund to put in it. Is that what you're talking about doing, or something else?
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, that's exactly what we hope would happen. If you didn't have an account, this is another way to get you to understand that the 529 is out there. And again, signing up online, it's instant. You get an instant confirmation back with your account number. Take that number and deposit and write it down on the form, and you funded your account. So that's a great option that we're hoping folks take advantage of.
And if Representative Brewer were here this morning, she'd probably have some comments about that issue too, but for the moment we can probably pass on that. Other questions? Thank you very much. It's very, very helpful.
Thank you.
Do we have other people testify on this? Anyone else want to be heard on this bill this morning? Don't see anyone. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2728. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2547.
House Bill 2547 comes from the House Judiciary Committee, and it would allow state agency to serve notices of garnishment using either electronic, regular, or certified mail. And current statute requires that they only use certified mail. So this is primarily a cost-saving measure for the Department of Revenue. The fiscal impact statement has put a cost savings of $675,000 per biennium for the Department of Revenue by moving to potentially regular mail instead of certified mail, and the Employment Department savings at $165,000 per biennium in savings on the certified mail. And also, there's no revenue impact to the measure.
Thank you. Deborah Buchanan and Tim Martinez. Good morning again.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, you might recall that this bill was developed as a result of a list that the department sent over last summer on ways to enhance collection of taxes already owed. While this is not exactly that, it would result in some cost savings for the department by allowing us to use regular mail instead of certified mail return receipt requested. There still are protections for a garnishee in that we would not be able to proceed against them unless we have actually sent it by certified mail. So unless there are questions, that's my speech. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Martinez, welcome to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. You know, I look up there and see an evenly divided committee, and you probably look here and go, oh, my gosh, the bankers and the Department of Revenue are on the same page. It is the end of days. But, yes, it is my pleasure to be here, and I definitely want to thank the department and Deborah for her willingness to work with us on this bill. The reason it is a engrossed is because of their willingness to work with the Bankers Association on putting the amendments in the language. Basically, we continue to believe that certified mail is the best way to go, but we realize there is some technology changes coming down the road and others, and we're looking, as everybody is, as a way to save money. So there will be new methods that the department can use, and they'll be able to use those when they have agreements with the financial institution. So we support the bill, or we're neutral on the bill, which for us is a big step when it has Department of Revenue on it. Thank you.
And I'm assuming you're referring to sub C on page 11, page 2, line 11. And maybe perhaps some other pieces, too.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. Both, actually, it starts on line 3 through line 14.
I see. The whole piece there.
Yes,
sub 4.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Berger.
Well, just a comment, Mr. Martinez. It's so nice to see you up here agreeably agreeing.
Thank you, Madam Coach.
Yes. Thank you. I think I'll refrain from making a comment on that topic. But I am interested in the fact that this bill seems to be devoid of a large numbers of details. There's a bill that's on the floor this morning that I worked very hard with Department of Administrative Services trying to get it just right, involving email as an alternative to mailed notice, and we worked to get that one so that it actually fit with the uniform code on that subject, and also to make certain that people who wanted to could opt out of it. It looks like you've come up with a different method, and that is you can send it by email. But if you do, you can't use any sanctions if the garnishee doesn't comply, if I've read the sub C correctly. And that's a different alternative, of course. It simply means that the usual suspects, for garnishees, will have to reach some kind of agreements with the department about how they're to be notified. And I'm assuming, Mr. Martinez, that if the notification system is set up correctly, it may actually save your clients some extra work, because some of the electronic transfer can be entered directly into your records without the intervention of a clerk who might make a typographical error or transposition or something, if it's set up correctly.
Right, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, as I say, we do thank the department. I think the solution we did agree to is pretty elegant, because
yeah.
It does say, you know, you can go ahead and do it all these different ways, as you mentioned. If we do not have an agreement, you can't sanction us, but we can work together and develop, you know, the new technologies to make it work and to save costs on both sides.
Right. And one more question. These garnishments that we're talking about, they're mainly going to employers, banks for bank accounts, credit unions, that kind of people, I assume. Although I know you can garnish pretty much anybody who holds assets for the debtor, but most of the time those are places where it's going to go, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, most of our garnishments actually are wage garnishments.
Yes.
About double the number of bank garnishments. So 34,000 wage garnishments, 17,000 bank garnishments in a fiscal year.
Okay. But this is the 17,000 is a big enough number, so it's worth the time of the bankers to work on setting up a protocol.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, yes, and we also are employers too, so occasionally.
yeah. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on House Bill 2547?
Again, Mr. Chair, we've emptied the room.
We've emptied the room. And we'll get you out in time for caucus meeting. With that, we'll close the work session. We finished the agenda. Mazen, do I need to make any other notices this morning? We've carried over one work session. We're going to reschedule a second one, and we're otherwise finished. Right? All right. Thank you. With that, the committee is adjourned.